To commemorate the 80th anniversary of D-Day, we'll be releasing three special episodes to tell the full story of the longest day. This second part is a complete remastering of our original Overlord episode with the addition of much new content.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this special episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. D-Day 80, Part 2, Overlord. 80 years ago today, more than 150,000 Allied troops were boarding planes, gliders and landing craft as they prepared to invade Fortress Europe in Operation Overlord, the Normandy invasion. Meanwhile, 200 miles away in the Buckinghamshire countryside, the Codebreakers of GC&CS were also ready and waiting. Naval Section spent the day decrypting German messages and forwarding that vital intelligence to Allied commanders, in many cases only 2.5 hours after the German operators had sent them. Today at Bletchley Park, our archive holds hundreds of these handwritten decrypts, and using a selection of these, we will tell the story of the longest day. Our research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, and research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, will be your guides, with the help of 12 of our veterans' memories from that eventful day. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
By reading wireless messages intercepted at sites around the UK and abroad, and producing mountains of detailed intelligence about German forces in France, Bletchley Park had played a key role in the planning for D-Day. With the invasion now underway, its role turned to providing real-time intelligence. It was recognised as the operation progressed, up-to-date intelligence would be vital. We tend to view D-Day as a land battle, but it was also an immensely complex and risky naval operation. And if it was found that the Germans were about to spring any surprises on the fleet, any delay in reporting the fact could mean disaster. Therefore, the naval section at Bletchley Park looked into ways to increase the speed of its service, and for the first and only time in the war, arrangements were made to intercept messages at Bletchley Park itself by a section known as Naval Section 5X. From the 22nd of May 1944, the 24 male naval ratings were based in Hut 18, which used to be Hut 8, where Alan Turing had worked earlier in the war. And they passed intercepts onto the Naval Enigma section in Block D and the Naval Intelligence section in Block A. On a daily basis, the section monitored first what they called cover A frequencies, which were known to provide predictable cribs, which could be put into the bomb machines and used to break the German home water cipher called Dolphin. Once Dolphin became readable, the operators would shift onto cover B frequencies, which carried more operationally important messages. Some of these frequencies appear in the collection of D-Day messages which we hold at Bletchley Park, so many of these messages were almost certainly intercepted right here, back in 1944.
On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to every soldier in the Allied team. To us is given the honour of striking a blow for freedom which will live in history. And in the better days that lie ahead, men will speak with pride of our doings. We have a great and a righteous cause. Let us pray that the Lord, mighty in battle, will go forth with our armies, and that his special providence will aid us in the struggle. I want every soldier to know that I have complete confidence in the successful outcome of the operations that we are now about to begin. With stout hearts, and with enthusiasm for the contest, let us go forward to victory.
Good This is London calling in the European News Service of the British Broadcasting Corporation. Here is the news. But first, here are some messages for our friends in occupied countries. The Trojan War will not be held. John is growing a very long beard this week. The long sobs of the violins of autumn. Les sanglots longs des violons de l'automne. Wound my heart with a monotonous languor.
I always tried to go home for my dad's birthday. It was the 6th of June. And I remember standing on Bedford platform waiting to get the train. And a troop train went through. And it was round about the 6th of June. They all waved as went through, you know, and made noises. Because I was there in my WAC uniform with my bag waiting for the next train. So I often wonder if they were men that were being sent up.
The defenders of the Atlantic Wall knew that an invasion was coming. The question was where, when, and how. During the night of the 5th of June, the significance of the Allied air activity was initially unclear. And even when paratroopers were encountered and the fleet was spotted, it was possible the invasion was merely a raid. However, as the size of the landings became clear, the reality that this must herald the long-awaited invasion of Europe sank in. Even then, Allied deception efforts had successfully indicated the possibility that an even greater attack might land somewhere else.
The first aircraft that is going to lead the very front in the early hours of tomorrow morning is turning onto the end of the tarmac to make its takeoff. A graceful machine, and its wingtip light shining red and green over the heads of the dark, small figures of people on the aerodrome watching it take off. Taking off from here loaded with parachutists, and taking with it perhaps the hopes and the fears and the prayers of millions of people in this country who sleep tonight not knowing that this mighty operation is taking place. There she goes now, the first aircraft leading the attack on Europe.
Sent at 2358 on the 5th of June to all units of the 2nd Defence Division, immediate readiness.
The 2nd Security Division was responsible for light vessels like patrol boats, gunboats and minesweepers defending the Normandy coast. It had likely been alerted by reports of the airborne drops which had begun some 90 minutes earlier, as well as the increased Allied naval activity.
Sent at 008 on the 6th of June, most immediate. From Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Admiral Channel. From 01:21 hours onwards, second degree of readiness enforced at order of 319th Infantry Division.
This division was on the Channel Islands and had become aware of the high level of air activity as the Allied airborne forces prepared to overfly the Kottatan Peninsula from west to east.
We were fire watching, and during the 6th, of course, the sun comes up early. And we were having a rest with old mattresses on this concrete floor. And we heard this enormous noise, and we opened the door to the outside, because it was a hot place in Istanbul, and the whole sky was full of aircraft. Absolutely full. You could hardly put a pin between them. I mean, we knew perfectly well it was on the cards to a certain extent. Yes. We didn't know when, because we'd been restricted to being only going down to the village, I think, or something like that, for at least a fortnight beforehand.
Sent at 0010, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Admiral Channel Coast. Some of the parachutists reported were straw dummies.
The sea landings were preceded by large airborne drops which aimed to secure both flanks of the invasion and the routes off the beaches. As well as the personnel of two American divisions and one British, 500 dummy paratroopers, nicknamed Rupert's, were dropped in key locations, along with SAS men who played loud recordings of battle noise. The aim was to sow confusion about the true location of the drops, or even suggest that the whole operation was a bluff. However, the Germans appeared to have quickly seen through the deception, and they correctly reported.
Sent at 0024, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Admiral Channel. Some parachutists captured. Landings continue.
We dropped at 10 to 1 in the morning. There was a moon and some drifting clouds. Just a perfect night for dropping. We landed east of the eye. Funny thing, I was number 13 in the first plane. The 13th man to land in France.
Sent at 0058, from Admiral Channel Coast to Sea Defence Commandant Channel Islands. Airborne landing at south end of east side of Cotentin Peninsula.
Covered by watchful air fighters, the American units left their various harbours in southeastern England to meet the British units at a rendezvous off the Isle of Wight. Our strategic air bombardment never let up. Through endless attacks on key bridges and rail centres, the ability of the enemy to shift reserves was fatally restricted. Under complete radio silence, each ship took its proper place in the vast armada. At twilight came the signal for the dash across the channel.
The build-up for D-Day, we had a flatbed plot of the channel, which was renewed every day. And we were plotting like mad, not just the real invasion stuff, but the false invasion stuff as well. Because we were trying to persuade the Germans that we were going to invade in Calais, and we weren't, we were going to invade Normandy. So there were two lots of stuff going on. And then there were the German E-boats, which were particularly dangerous to us in the channel, and French fishing boats, the lot. And it got so busy at that time that sometimes you stopped a second watch and just went on, because it was terribly important to keep it up to date. You were supposed to plot every single one. I mean, we eliminated every day and started again. Obviously, we didn't do down to fishing boats, but all the naval craft and, of course, the build-up of the harbours and mulberries, we were plotting to show where they were and where they were going. It was terribly exciting. I can remember an awful moment when I nearly missed HR. We'd been told D-Day as soon as it was possible to tell us. And then a signal came through about HR almost before the daily report was made. And I pretty well finished the report. And the other end said to me, "Jean, don't forget HR." I put it in at the bottom of the report.
The Navy's first response to the Allied activity was to order its craft to sweep the coast for the reported enemy landing craft. At 0455, three vessels of 5th Torpedo Boat Flotilla and six of the 15th Patrol Boat Flotilla left Le Havre.
Sent at 0154 to Hoffman, attack landing boats off Bourg-en-Bessin and Grandcon. Sent at 0155 to Rale, most immediate. Attack landing boats off Ouistigam and Cabourg.
Hoffman was directed to the area of Omaha Beach, and Rahl was directed to the British sector.
In the wardroom, dinner. From the menu, soup, roast beef and green peas, and apples and cream, it might have been a crossing to Cherbourg in peacetime. And then you realised that your hand was moving just a little sluggishly to your mouth. Your tummy wasn't just where it usually was. The men around you were rather silent. And when they spoke, they were self-conscious. It was a room full of men on the way.
In the dawn twilight, the approaching Allied ships were becoming visible.
Sent at 0306, most immediate, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy. Abreast of Marcouf Island, 15 dark spots, course south.
We have yet to see a German plane over the amphibious convoy, which doesn't necessarily mean that we shan't see them before the attack is over. And as far as I know, no report has come in of attack by a Nazi sea craft onto the convoys. Now it's almost black dark, and you see the ships lying in all directions, just like black shadows on the gray sky, some signaling out to sea, signaling with red lights, blinking code. There are four fires on the shore, looking like pinpoints, winking, smudged by smoke. Now planes are going overhead. That baby was plenty low. Heavy firing now just behind us. An anti-aircraft burst in the sky.
At around 0530, the German boats encountered the Allied fleet, A firefight erupted between the warships and the German patrol boats.
Said at 0347, from Raal, I'm being fired at by heavy enemy units. Said at 0400, most immediate, from Raal, forced back by heavy units.
The three torpedo boats entered what looked like a bank of fog. In fact, it was a smokescreen designed to shield the Allied fleet from the heavy batteries in Le Havre. Bursting out of the smoke, the boats found themselves facing the entirety of Force S, heading for Sword Beach. This included the battleships HMS Warspite and Ramillies, 5 cruisers, 13 destroyers, and a host of smaller craft. This force immediately opened fire, and the patrol boats wisely turned to withdraw, but not before firing 18 torpedoes. These narrowly missed the battleships and the Force HQ ship HMS Largs, but their only victim was a brand new Norwegian destroyer, Svenna, which quickly broke in two and sank with the loss of 32 crew.
Sent at 0406, most immediate, from Hoffman. Heavy artillery fire from battleships and enemies, and remaining off Le Havre.
The German boats were still in the Bay of the Seine and under fire. Warspite's log reports that it hit and sank a destroyer at 0612. This was in fact boat 1509, probably a converted whaler or trawler used by the Germans as a patrol boat.
Sent at 0413, most immediate, from Raal. Boat 1509 hit and sinking. Sent at 0425, from Hoffman. 6 battleships, about 20 destroyers, torpedoes expended in attacking. Heavy consumption of ammunition. I'm off Le Havre.
At this point, Raal received an order to go up the Seine. He replied, doubtless with some annoyance, that the river was not passable for another 3 hours. Instead, the boat sought shelter in Le Havre.
Harry tells me this tune is really new. Kitty Callan sings it, so as time goes by, keep listening for In Times Like These.
We interrupt this program of music by Harry James and his orchestra to bring you a bulletin just received in the WOR newsroom. London. The German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. This, however, is an unsubstantiated enemy claim. We repeat, this is an unsubstantiated enemy claim. Stay tuned to WOR for further details. We return you now to the music of Harry James and his orchestra.
All the lights dimmed out with darkness all above.
And then, of course, D-Day came, and one of our number who was off duty roused us all at 4 a.m. and said it started. We all went out on the cliff, and you watched a lot of convoys going down towards the west, landing craft and all these things being built up north, had to go around Hellfire Corner to go down, obviously, to Portsmouth, including the Mulberry Harbour. And the Mulberry Harbour was like tables upside down with 4 legs, and we could not think what this was, but they used to float past.
From where I am, standing between the 2 pilots of this glider, I can see the navigation lights of the tug in front of us, and off to left and right, the navigation lights of other tugs and other gliders bound on the same mission. Circling above from time to time, I can see the lights of the fighter screen, which is protecting us. And looking back down the glider, there are seated, although I can't see them in the half light, officers and men, all laden up with equipment so heavily that they can barely walk. But they've got to carry with them the means by which they can fight the moment they land.
Sent at 0347 from Sea Defence Commandant Trondheim. Enemy measures on the Channel coast suggest the beginning of major actions. Vigilance should therefore be increased.
By this point, the news was spreading, and units in northern Norway were being put on alert.
Sent at 0430 from 11th U-Boat Flotilla, 2 U-276 Borkers and U-348 Schunk. Immediate readiness. There are indications that the invasion has begun.
This message is from the HQ of 11th U-Boat Flotilla to two U-Boats, both apparently in Norway at the time.
Infantry units that would comprise the second assault wave began transferring into their assault boats. The first assault wave was already standing by, waiting for the signal to dash inshore. There would be little time between the first assault wave and the second.
Sent at 0542. Most immediate. Off Grandcamp and north of the Orne, numerous landing craft, among them large ships.
H hour, and the enemy's hedgehog defenses are ahead. This is the supreme moment of invasion. This is frontal assault on an entrenched enemy. Heroic medical corpsmen remove wounded for return to England. Some landing craft are stranded on sandbars, and a tank founders.
Sent at 0717, most immediate, from Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Marcouf area under heavy artillery fire. Between Vire and Orne, principally at Vireville and Colville, enemy tanks on land. Steep coast near Pont d'Orc ascended with scaling ladders. Fighting in progress. No news from area Ravanaville to Vire Estuary.
The main landing zones became obvious soon after Allied troops began to go ashore. Four of the beaches, Omaha, Gold, Juno and Sword, were all between the Vire and Orne rivers. This message particularly highlights Omaha, which was next to the villages of Vireville and Colville. It also mentions Pointe du Hoc, which was famously captured by US Army Rangers, who scaled the cliffs to capture the battery on top.
D-Day, 8 hour plus 30 minutes. Here on the right wing of the attack, Yanks go ashore under fire. This is it. Navy shells drop in the background. The beach is loaded with mines, swept by enemy bullets. A tiny beachhead seized. Americans huddle in the cover of a cliff whose heights the enemy still controls. Digging in to await the mounting of the next attack.
The area between Ravenaville and Vire was the location of Utah Beach, captured with little difficulty early that morning.
Sent at 0759, most immediate, from Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Arromanche reports five tanks have landed near Anel. English artillery is firing inland. There seems to be a fairly large landing near Versemer, as large formations are patrolling there. Continuous air raids, severe bombing attacks. Over 200 units, including destroyers, have been sighted.
An hour later, the naval radar installation at Arromanche reported in with more news of the British and Canadian sector. Anel and Versemer were adjacent to Gold Beach.
All hands to beaching station!
This is the day and this is the hour. The sky is lightning. Lightning over the coast of Europe as we go in. The sun is blazing down brightly now. It's almost like an omen the way it suddenly came out just as we were going in. The whole sky is bright, the sea is a glittering mass of silver, with all these craft of every kind moving across it, and the great battleships in the background blazing away at the shore.
I do remember the day when finally we'd started the invasion, because two girls who weren't in our room at all, they were just down the corridor, burst in upon us. "They've invaded! They've invaded!" Because they had a radio of their own and they'd heard that actually D-Day had happened. And of course we were all thinking, oh good, this is all going to be over now. Well, of course it wasn't over straight away, but anyway, it's more difficult than that. But that was an excitement. We went on working. The funny thing was that the soldiers were so shattered that instead of doing the usual thing, they've almost threw their pencils in the air and said, "Achtung, der Tommy kommt." Watch out, the Tommies are coming, in their own language, in plain language, instead of anything. And so we all said hooray, you see, because the Tommies had kommt.
Yes.
Now, there's two important factors to keep in mind about these naval messages. Firstly, they're from the naval perspective. The Navy see their primary role in a defensive operation as dealing with the enemy fleet, not the land forces. Details about the land fighting are quite threadbare, but there's often precise information about Allied naval forces. Army commanders would have had a pretty good idea of what was happening on the beaches, pretty much immediately, whereas naval commanders were left in the dark for longer. Secondly, these are high-level messages. Most immediate tactical communication would have used the telephone networks which connected the various defensive positions and headquarters. This means the Enigma messages were mostly periodic situation reports and the like, intended to keep the higher commanders in the loop about the progress of the wider battle. It was because this information had long-term relevance that it needed to be encrypted, because telephone cables which could be tapped were not considered secure. The exception is individual naval vessels which needed to send tactical information by wireless, and they had the space to house Enigma machines.
4,000 ships and thousands of smaller craft. The gathering of the mighty armada. Warships of the Royal Navy with units of the Canadian and United States navies range their main armor on the coastal batteries.
Sent at 0840. Most immediate. From Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Aromanche Bayeux Road shelled. 35 tanks destroyed near Anel. Further landings. Defence by own artillery. Long is still being shelled.
The Long Sommer battery, mentioned here, was the largest in the centre of the invasion fleet. It was involved in a long series of duels with British, French and American warships throughout the day. And by the end of the day, three of its four guns had been disabled.
Sent at 10.01 from Captain U-Boats, Norway, to Grimm and Trutz groups. Landings by numerous gliders and parachute troops began at 0100 hours, 6th of June, in the Seine Bay. Apparently the commencement of the invasion in the west.
By now, news of the Normandy landings was reaching other theatres. This message was broadcast on what Bletchley Park called the Arctic U-Boat Service. It was still a possibility that an even greater attack was yet to take place somewhere else.
Sent at 10.01, most immediate, from Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Interim report. Number 1, tactical situation. No reports from the Saint-Malo area. West side of Cotentin, nothing. Off the north coast, there are no ship targets in the area of the batteries, but there are distant targets to the northwest. The air situation in the Cherbourg area is quiet. Scattered groups of paratroops have been captured in the fortress area. Shelling by ship's guns on the east side of Cotentin from Saint-Va as far as Vire. Army coastal batteries are firing, and Marcouf will be ready to fire in 30 minutes. Parachute descents and landing activity at Ravanoville. Heavy flow of landing boats at the mouth of the Vire. Isigny is in our hands, but there is an enemy penetration at Aromanche. Tank landings at Anel. The Long battery is firing. Number 2. Internal situation. Fortress area is quiet. Tott organisation has been released for York and Hamburg by the Corps. Number 3. Casualties reported so far. Marcouf, 5 dead, 12 civilly wounded. La Panelle, about 25 men entombed.
The unit landed squarely on the German troops. These enemy units were on maneuvers and were already occupying their assigned defensive positions. Surprise was gained only by the leading parachute unit, and subsequent serials found themselves under practically continuous ground and anti-aircraft fire while crossing the peninsula and upon landing. 821 airplane loads, 13,000 paratroops were delivered into DZs in less than 2 hours.
And then at the end of that time, we were sent down to Bischofswerfen to establish a section, number 7 section at Bischofswerfen, which we were there from its 7 section through D-Day, which was quite exciting on its own from our point of view, until I moved on further from there in October. D-Day, particularly, I remember quite well, because I was on duty at midnight that night. I was on the night shift. And before we went on, our CO told us that we might be expecting a very busy night, but we had no idea what it was. But we'd already heard the planes going over during the late evening, which was obviously the paratroops going across on D-Day. We went on duty, and as soon as you got on there, it was mad. The traffic, what we call the traffic, was the obviously the most coming through, was all sorts of stuff coming through, even which is had never been heard of before, German plain language. They were sending the ordinary German language in Morse, which I knew a bit of German from school, So it was quite interesting being right. I knew when I before came before E and things like that, riding them down. But it was quite an exciting night. None of us wanted to go off duty that next morning.
Send at 0853 from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy. Most immediate. About 600 paratroopers near Turqueville.
This village was at the centre of the airborne perimeter loosely held by the American 101st and 82nd Airborne Divisions behind Utah Beach, near the town of San Miraglis.
Meanwhile, the airborne infantry had fanned out and taken initial objectives, most of them after hard fighting and heavy losses. Now they're moving through the key town of San Miraglis.
Sent at 11:06 from R221, the Benouville Bridge over the Caen Canal is in the hands of the British. Two gliders have landed and withdrawing after a brush with the enemy.
This message is probably from a gunboat based in Ouistreham on the coast. Two boats had tried to make their way up the canal to Caen. One was knocked out with a piat by the oxen bucks who had occupied the bridge, and the crew were taken prisoner. The other retreated the way it had come and sent this message reporting on the encounter.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is a special bulletin read by John Snay. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress. The first official news came just after 9:30, when Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, usually called SHAPE from its initials, issued communique number one. This said, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces supported by strong air forces began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
Reading these messages, it's sometimes clear that the Germans were too busy to communicate with each other. The following message was sent in two parts, nearly 2 hours after it was dictated. It took some time to encipher an Enigma message since the letters had to be keyed in one by one, and then the letters which lit up on the lamp board written down by hand before being handed over to the wireless operator. But it's also likely that a certain amount of chaos at the headquarters probably slowed down the process even further.
Sent at 17:29 from Grupa West to All. Evening situation. Only air landings in the area Deauville to the Orne. Area has been cleared up. The focal part of the enemy landings is Orne to Port-en-Bessin, especially to eastwards of Aromanche. The enemy is on both sides of the Orne Canal as far as to northwards of Blainville. Powerful countermeasures are in progress. Air and sea landings between Port-en-Bessin and Vire have been cleaned up except for a pocket of resistance at Saint-Pierre. Between Saint-Var and Vire, in the Marcouf area, fairly large air and sea landings. Also landings between Vire and Revanneville. The whole area is under own control. The enemy is employing powerful air and naval forces. Barfleur and Saint-Var shelled from the sea. West of Le Havre, presumably thrusting towards the Trouville area, there are powerful surface forces consisting of battleships, cruisers, and numerous destroyers.
Late in the day, the Germans had decided the greatest danger lay in the British and Canadian sector. The powerful countermeasures probably referred to the counterattacks of the 21st Panzer Division, but these would make little progress on either side of the Orne. The pocket of resistance at Saint-Pierre was Pointe Hoc. Apparently, the Germans believed the landings on Omaha Beach had been repulsed. They also seem unaware of the progress of the Utah Beach landing, where the whole area was certainly not under German control. The commanders in Paris seem to have been somewhat overconfident about the situation.
With beaches free of enemy fire, the Allies streamed heavy equipment ashore. Lumbering bulldozers set about clearing the way for vital air landing strips. The blast of Allied shells left shattered German defenses and many dead German defenders. Survivors were given prompt attention by Medical Corps men. Some were grateful, many bewildered by the smashing Allied blow. Doughboys and Tommies pushed forward yard by yard into the villages and small towns.
Sent at 15:47, most immediate, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Admiral Channel Coast. Number one, tactical situation. West coast of Cotentin, nothing. Off the north coast, there are only shipping formations near Barfleur, 10 to 15 miles off, including troop transports which are stationary, apparently disembarking into boats. bombing attacks on the east coast on 7/1261 battery, which is ready to fire. Marcouf is being heavily shelled by 38cm guns. Two guns out of service owing to a direct hit on the embrasures, several wounded. Landings near 2/1261 is firing landing barrage fire. Bridges have been captured on both sides of the canal near Blainville, and our troops are slowly withdrawing. Number 2, internal situation. Nothing to report. Number 3, further casualties reported. Two dead, several seriously wounded.
We actually decoded the stuff from Bletchley Park.
Right.
So we knew before the people above. Now, when I was at Caserta, and I remember the night that the invasion of Normandy started, I was on watch in Caserta, where the two generals, Mark Clark, who was the 5th American Army, and Alexander, who was the 8th Army and the overall commander of the Italian operation. And the wireless operator buzzed me, and I went in, and he said, a 5Z coming through, a 1Z message coming through. It wasn't important. It was 5Z, really waiting for every letter coming off the wireless operator. So I set my machine up, the Typex machine, as the first bit of coding came, and he brought the message in. And I remember putting it in my machine and reading the plain language coming out. And it was sent at about 1:25, and that literally about an hour before. It had been picked up, Bletchley, and back to home. Yeah. It was from a German abwehr, the German intelligence. And it said, Allied paratroops dropping on the point of Barfleur. And I had the honour, if that's the word, of taking the message down to the aide-de-camp of these two chaps and saying, will you please waken these gentlemen up? I have to pass this privately to them. And so I passed the message. So I think I was probably the first man in Italy to know that Normandy had started.
Tanks begin to rumble ashore as our bridgeheads are extended. Armour for the assault and capture of Bayeux and the heavy fighting around Caen. Stiffening of resistance was to be expected. A Boche with his face bashed about a bit joins the gang of his fellow countrymen taken prisoner. Just a few chipped off Hitler's army of occupation for whom the invasion bell tolls.
Sent at 15:49, most immediate. From Location HQ Collecting Centre Normandy to Location HQ Channel Arromanche. Base surrounded at 1500 hours. Sets blown up. Communications have broken down.
The radar installation at Arromanche was captured on the afternoon of D-Day by the 1st Hampshires coming off Gold Beach.
I'm lying down at full length here in the cornfield. Just in the hedges around me, I can see many men taking shelter behind the banks wearing their steel helmets while this terrific barrage goes on around us. In this barrage, we've got our 4.2-inch mortars, our field guns, our medium guns, all the guns of the fleet. The shells are whistling overhead now. Just listen to them.
Sent at 16:25 from Grupa West to all. The enemy landing Deauville de Saint-Va, now in progress, is recognisable as a major operation. The proclamation by the Allied leaders and the disposition of enemy forces point to further major operations, but no details are available regarding their targets. Be prepared for surprise attacks in further areas.
The invasion was publicly announced by the Allied leaders, but they were careful to leave open the suggestion that further attacks might follow. Deception efforts were also continued in a bid to keep German forces in the Pas-de-Calais. It would not be until late July that the German High Command began to agree that Normandy was the main invasion.
Sent at 18:02, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Grupa West. Artillery Commander 118 requests permission for the immediate blowing up of Morzelin Lighthouse, as it is an aiming point for enemy ships' guns.
Permission was granted at 21:05, and the lighthouse was indeed demolished. It's likely that the Allies themselves would have done this sooner or later to eliminate a possible viewpoint for German artillery observers.
We're trying to get the LTVP in closer to pick up the men who have been wading ashore in this cold sea and choppy wind. Thank you. Go on over here. Chafford, who is one of the sailors, has just come in with a handful of sand because he heard me say a while ago that what I wanted to do most of all was just to get ashore and reach down and take up a handful of sand and say, this is France, and I've got it in my hand. France at last after 4 years. Chafford, how does it feel to just to reach down and grab a piece of sand and say, I'm grabbing French soil, huh?
Well, since I was born in France, it has special meaning to me.
Where were you born?
In Calais.
You were? Well, that's not very far from here. Well, it has a special meaning for me, too, as you can imagine. Have you got some? We've got to save this. We've got to put it in a bottle or something. We've got our men aboard all with handfuls of France in their hands, and we're going to save it because this has been a momentous occasion for all of us. There go our motors. The ramp is going up. We're backing away from the beach now. And soon we'll be out in the salt spray, and it'll be impossible for us to broadcast anymore.
They sent me into the Utah sector, which was the westernmost part of the invasion. That was the American, as you know, they had the Omaha and Utah beaches. The Omaha was pretty disastrous. We were on the Utah, taking troops into Utah.
And you were on an American ship at this time?
Yes, the Forrester. I was, of course, in with my set. I didn't really
see
what was going on. People asked me, what was it like? I don't know. I came up on deck and I saw this sort of ship sticking out of the water. And somebody told me that was the sister ship. The troops had already gone ashore then. I think I should have gone in the Guinness Book of Records. I was on duty from the time I left Plymouth, and they were delayed a whole day for the invasion. And, of course, I was still on watch when the landing took place. So I don't know, I was something like 40 hours on watch.
Goodness. But there was just you. There was nobody to relieve
yes,
you.
Yes, I don't know why they sent one person. Because in the British ships, I'd always had another operator, and we worked it out. We were very organised on the East Coast convoys. Mm. And I had no support at all. And they were very good on the American ship. I remember the signals officer, he just let me sleep when I couldn't stay awake any longer. And I remember on one occasion when they discovered the body of a British serviceman and they were going to bury it, and the other members of the crew wanted me to be at the service, you see. And the signals officer said, no, let him sleep. So they were very good.
The story of the landings can also be told from the viewpoint of just one group of German defenders, the 300-man garrison of the Crispeck Battery, overlooking the east coast of the Cotentin Peninsula, near the French village of Saint-Marcouf. The battery contained three 210mm coastal defence guns and was operated by the German Navy under the command of Oberleutnant Zurzee, or Naval Lieutenant Walter Irmsen. The first news from the battery arrived at Bletchley at just after 3 a.m. GMT, when the German admiral commanding the Normandy area asked for a report.
Sent at 0309 from Admiral Channel Coast to Sea Defence Commandant Normandy. What is the situation at batteries on the east coast of Cotentin?
The reply was received that as dawn had broken, the battery had observed enemy ships out at sea as well as landing boats and was engaging them.
Sent at 0359 from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Admiral Channel Coast. Not in touch with Long. Batteries on east coast of Cotentin are firing at landing boats and are in order. Marcouf gunfire from sea. Via Orne 1-3 in order.
US troops would actually land at Utah Beach to the south of the battery at 6:30 local time. However, the area covered by the battery from Marcouf north to Saint-Vaast remained clear.
Sent at 0537 from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Admiral Channel Coast. Most immediate. 0700 report about landings was premature. Samvar to Markouf Bay clean. Gunnery duel between coast and ships continues. Ships are putting up a smoke screen.
Among the warships pouring ton upon ton of steel into Nazi defenses is a mighty veteran, USS Nevada, back from the grave at Pearl Harbor.
The long-range fighting was fierce. Markouf Battery became involved in a duel with the US battleship Nevada, as well as the cruisers Tuscaloosa and Quincy, and several smaller vessels. The German gunners were soon able to report a small victory.
Sent at 0540, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy, most immediate. Ships between Markouf and the mainland brought under fire. One ship exploded.
The ship in question was the USS Corrie, a destroyer. The ship was hit several times by German shells and broke her back before sinking. However, the German gunners could not claim all the credit, as it was subsequently recorded that the destroyer had also hit a mine. Damage was also being inflicted on the battery by the big guns of the US ships.
Sent at 0551, from Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Most immediate. Enemy cruisers after fire from Markouf sank at 0720. Battery unserviceable. One gun sustained direct hit.
The coastal defences are softened up. Daybreak. The naval bombardment continues.
Two further US battleships had joined the fight, USS Texas and USS Arkansas, and a 14-inch shell from USS Nevada hit one of the concrete casemates in the battery, destroying one gun. The Germans could also see the landing forces approaching Utah Beach.
Sent at 0711, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy. Most immediate. Markouf reports a great many landing craft approaching, protected by battleships and cruisers.
A second gun at the battery was destroyed at about 9 a.m, leaving only one still firing. Unfortunately, this gun could not be traversed to shoot where the attacking ships were, but it could bombard the invading troops on the beaches to the south. Bletchley would hear of this later in the day at around 3 p.m. GMT.
Sent at 1531, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy to Admiral Channel Coast. Most immediate. Markouf is under heavy fire from 38-centimetre guns. Second gun put out of action by direct hit. Several men wounded.
Again, at about 5:30 p.m, reports came in that the battery was still being bombarded.
Sent at 17:30, from Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Shell fire from cruiser at the Markouf battery, and presumably 3/1261, at 18:10 hours. The intact gun of the Markouf battery has forced a destroyer to turn away. A new type of rocket shell has been fired into the Markouf area from the sea.
Our naval barrage swept the enemy beaches with brooms of fire. Operating inshore, fast rocket boats showered the enemy with their rain of death.
As the evening wore on, Markouf was also attacked from the air.
Sent at 2046 from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy. Bomb dropped on Markouf battery. Inside battery. Heavy smokescreen at the coast.
By 9 p.m. GMT, the situation of the German garrison of Markouf Battery was becoming desperate. However, the only support German naval command could offer to Oberleutnant Ermsen was not of the most practical kind.
Sent at 2110 from Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Most immediate. WN in front of Markouf Battery occupied after bombing attack, smokescreen. Embrasure 2 Markouf on fire. Cannot be extinguished. Suggest Iron Cross First Class be awarded to Senior Officer Markouf for his outstanding achievements.
Ermsen and his men fought on for another 5 days, and the battery changed hands several times. Finally, out of ammunition and supplies, the Oberleutnant and 78 unwounded survivors successfully escaped to the German lines. He would be awarded the Knight's Cross for his efforts at Marcouf before becoming a prisoner of war when Cherbourg fell to the Allies on 26th of June. Ermsen survived the war and went on to join the Federal Navy in the 1960s. He was also involved in arranging sailing events for the 1972 Munich Olympics. He died in Kiel in 1988 at the age of 77.
We formed SLU-8. Six of us were sent to Bletchley Park. And 2 weeks before D-Day, we were sent down to Portsmouth and we were billeted in the same mansion that all the top officers and generals were there. You know, yeah. Montgomery, Eisenhower, Tedder, they were all there. And we weren't doing any work whatsoever. We were just hanging about, going into Portsmouth, came home on leave for a couple of days, and then D-Day was June the 6th, and on D-Day plus 3, there was a flurry, and someone came rushing in into where we were, and he said, you, I want you. We went out on a motor launch to Arromanches and joined Montgomery's 21st Army Group headquarters there. That's where we were. We were deciphering messages for him.
So did you think, this is important?
We only got half. Well, we all did. You know, we were all biting our nails. This is really something. General Montgomery's headquarters, messages to him, got to be something important.
Gosh.
They tucked us away. We weren't in his encampment. They tucked us away in the woods. We had a mobile cipher van, two Typex machines, two sergeants, and the officer, you know, we never saw him. And we were tucked away in the woods. And the reason for that, we were told, if the Germans ever overran us, we would have the opportunity to destroy, particularly the code book, and smash up the Typex, whatever. And Montgomery's chief of the intelligence, I think they called it C6, his name was Brigadier Williams. He was the number one intelligence man in his headquarters. And all the messages went to Montgomery, but they had to be given to him first.
There will be one more surprise to the Germans on D-Day.
As these gliders and their tow planes head into France, C-47s, which already have dropped their gliders, pass on their way back to England. Two-way traffic, and it's congested. Resupply ships took off simultaneously with the last glider serial from five airfields which were designated as takeoff fields for resupply by air. Supplies are dropped.
Sent at 1915, most immediate, from Sea Defence Commandant Normandy. Hundreds of gliders are continuously streaming over the north coast of Cotentin. The first wave landed near Saint-Vaast.
The paratroops are landing. They're landing all around me as I speak. They've come in from the sea, and they're fluttering down, red, white and blue parachutes fluttering down, and they're just about the best thing that we've seen for a good many hours. They're showering in. There's no other word for it.
Sent at 1929, most immediate, from Sea Defence Commandant Sen Somme. Strong formations of transport AC with freight-carrying gliders, approximate direction Caen.
The Germans were reporting on the airborne reinforcement of both ends of the beachhead. The parachutes Alan Melville watched were supply drops, and the colours represented different stores. The sight of the drops caused German troops of the 21st Panzer Division, who had counterattacked towards Sword Beach that afternoon, to fall back to their start line for fear of being outflanked from the air.
A bent old woman in a black shawl bids us good day. She stayed in bed through it all, she says, but the ceiling fell in on top of her, and now she's no habitable home. So much the worse, monsieur, but it can't be helped. A barber invites us in for a shave, and just at that moment the guns from one of our cruisers in the bay open up and shells go hurtling overhead. We think they might unsteady his hand. We decline politely.
Sent at 2017, most immediate, from CNC Gruppe West to Senior Officer 5th T Flotilla. The situation demands that the orders for all-out torpedo operations for the night of 6th to 7th of June should stand. Senior Officer Flotilla will decide independently time of sailing and form of execution. Recommends combination with operation by blitz-laying groups.
German naval forces were back out that night in the Channel attempting to damage the Allied fleet and lay mines, but they were outnumbered and outgunned. Most of the craft in the area would be sunk over the following week. On top of that, 18 U-boats would be lost operating against the landings.
Yes, there they were, off the sands of Normandy and the mine-sown grass of Calvados. And Eisenhower's was the face that had launched 4,000 ships. From these ships, men, guns, tanks, and every device that brains could conceive to break down an Atlantic war. Welcome, John Doe from Kansas. Welcome, Charlie Hardcastle from Manchester. Welcome, Harry Smith from Toronto. 4 years we have waited for you to come, but better late, oh, so much better late than never. Bienvenue, Monty. That's a big jump nearer to finishing your job.
Sent at 21:35 on the 6th of June. Most immediate. From Sea Defence Commandant, Normandy. Day's report. Number 1. Tactical situation up to 1600 as in morning, intermediate and evening reports. Have blown up Arromanche installations ourselves. Northeast and east of Saint-Vin, fairly large fighting and landing vessels in readiness. From 2055 hours onwards, landings near Saint-Vin in separate waves of freight-carrying gliders. Number 2. Internal situation. Cherbourg Fortress quiet. Number 3. Naval casualties reported. 20 dead. 40 seriously wounded. About 25 entombed. Several lightly wounded. Fate of Arromanche personnel uncertain. No reports from Long.
The Arromanche radar station had been captured on the afternoon of D-Day, and the heavily battered Longsomer battery would surrender to the 2nd Devonshire Regiment at midday on the 7th of June.
Reinforcements continued to pour ashore. Artillery and heavy engineering equipment were firmly established. The German boast that an invading force could not remain ashore for 9 hours had been flung back on the now desperate defenders. Hitler's fortress had been cracked. The great gamble had been won, having accomplished what many European military leaders believed never could be done, a cross-channel invasion. The Allies were now in position to apply their great power to the methodical destruction of the German armed might, to bring retribution to the fiendish criminals that had conceived it, to scourge it and them from the face of the earth.
Immediately after D-Day, we were given a pep talk by a chap in charge of the log readers at the time, Blair Cunningham. Yeah, he was in charge of the log readers at that time. Well, he was in charge of the fusion room as well. But it wasn't known as Sixer at that time, not on D-Day, I'm pretty sure of that. And he gave a pep talk. It was the morning after D-Day, and his voice was very throaty, and he said, "I apologise, I've been on the telephone all night talking." The scrambler telephone.
I know when we first went on ops, we were terrified, and we hope we never hear anything coming through. And the sergeant said, "That will soon change." And surely it did. You wanted something to come through because you were sitting there for about 6 hours hearing nothing, doing nothing. So you wanted to hear something. But I tell you what, June the 6th, 1944, you couldn't cope. The messages were coming through at you like mad. And the set was nearly jumping off the bench. What on earth's going on here? We knew something dreadful was happening, and of course it was the D-Day landings. But that was the only time that I ever remember anything exciting happening. It was all very mundane, actually. They did tell you now and again if you had done good work, but very little they told you. Very little.
Dusk on D-Day saw the Allies in firm control of all five landing beaches and 156,000 men ashore. Bridges at either end of the invasion area had been captured. Coastal batteries had been suppressed or destroyed, and the only armoured counterattack of the day had been turned back with the loss of some 20 panzers. The landings had not reached all their ambitious objectives, but that should not cause us to overlook the fact that the landings combined two of the most difficult military operations that exist, amphibious landings and urban combats. There was good reason that Eisenhower had prepared an address to deliver in the event of a failure, but in the event the invasion went, for the most part, very smoothly indeed. And the risky naval operation probably went smoothest of all. The landings were only the small-scale precursor to a far larger campaign which would ultimately dwarf D-Day in scale and bloodshed.
Ici Londres. Les Français parlent aux Français.
People of Western Europe. A landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching. All patriots, men and women, young and old, have a part to play in the achievement of final victory. To members of resistance movements, whether led by nationals or by outside leaders, I say, follow the instructions you have received. To patriots who are not members of organized resistance groups, I say, continue your passive resistance, but do not needlessly endanger your lives. Wait until I give you the signal to rise and strike the enemy. The day will come when I shall need your united strength. Until that day, I call on you for the hard task of discipline and restraint. Citizens of France, I am proud to have again under my command the gallant forces of France. Fighting beside their allies, they will play a worthy part in the liberation of their homeland. Because the initial landing has been made on the soil of your country, I repeat to you with even greater emphasis my message to the peoples of other occupied countries in Western Europe. Follow the instructions of your leaders. A premature uprising of all Frenchmen may prevent you from being of maximum help to your country in the critical hour. Be patient. Prepare. As Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, there is imposed on me the duty and responsibility of taking all measures necessary to the prosecution of the war. Prompt and willing obedience to the orders that I shall issue is essential. Effective civil administration of France must be provided by Frenchmen. All persons must continue in their present duties unless otherwise instructed. Those who have made common cause with the enemy and so betrayed their country will be removed. When France is liberated from her oppressors, you yourselves will choose your representatives and the government under which you wish to live. In the course of this campaign for the final defeat of the enemy, you may sustain further loss and damage. Tragic though they may be, they are part of the price of victory. I assure you that I shall do all in my power to mitigate your hardships. I know that I can count on your steadfastness now, no less than in the past. The heroic deeds of Frenchmen who have continued the struggle against the Nazis and their Vichy satellites in France and throughout the French Empire have been an example and an inspiration to all of us. This landing is but the opening phase of the campaign in Western Europe. Great battles lie ahead. I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us now. Keep your faith staunch. Our arms are resolute. Together we shall achieve victory.
The full success of the first day would only become clear some 3 months later, when German resistance collapsed and the Allies swept across France, liberating Paris ahead of schedule and with a smaller cost in lives than they had forecast. The codebreakers at Bletchley Park would continue to support the campaign with up-to-date assessments of enemy movements, which allowed Allied commanders to second-guess the German intentions. But all of this stemmed from successfully getting ashore and staying ashore in the early and most precarious period. And this was achieved in large part thanks to the intelligence provided by Bletchley Park.
Originally, we worked in the house, and then a few months before D-Day, a watch room was built in the grounds, and we had a whole draft of sailors as well. And D-Day, three naval officers appeared, which was quite unprecedented. I mean, they didn't talk to us, they just sort of stood around. I mean, everybody knew that the invasion was imminent, but of course nobody knew the exact date. And then all three of our officers arrived. So we thought, you know, something must be happening. And in the end, we were told, yes, this is it. I came off watch at 2 a.m, knowing that it was on. And of course, I didn't want to come off watch.
No.
I wanted to stay on. I stayed around as long as I possibly could. But in the end, it was no good. I was sent packing. And of course, by this time, it was broad daylight. And I went out onto the cliff, which again was very near, and looked across to Calais. And I suppose you would call it boyfriend, unofficial fiancé. Anyway, he became my husband. He was a prisoner of war. And I remember I looked across saying, "It's come, dear, it's come. We're coming to get you."
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.